Maya Berliner, a young Jew from the Warsaw ghetto, had arrived at Treblinka in early September 1942. At the time, the Germans would select several hundred prisoners from the daily transports who would be forced to work for the SS, sorting the belongings of those who had been sent to the gas chambers. Berliner was one of those men who were destined to live a few days longer than their families and friends, before they too would face liquidation by the SS and replacement by fresh prisoners. In this manner, the Germans hoped to preserve the secret of Treblinka by disposing of any witnesses to their crimes. At evening roll call on the 10th of September, Berliner and several hundred other slaves lined up for counting, the parade being taken by Unterscharführer Max Bielas, supported by a dozen Ukrainian SS guards. Berliner had decided to strike, as he had judged it likely that Bielas was about to send the entire group to the gas chambers. When he had arrived at the camp, Berliner had managed to secrete a knife in his clothing, the Germans at this stage being less than thorough in their searching of new arrivals. Suddenly, Berliner drew the knife and lunged at a very surprised Bielas, stabbing him deeply in the chest. Seconds later, Berliner was gunned down by panicking Ukrainian SS men, who started firing their rifles indiscriminately into the shouting and screaming crowd of Jewish prisoners. At least 10 were killed and many more injured before SS NCOs arrived to take charge. Unterscharführer Bielas was taken off the square by medics and rushed by train to hospital, but he would die on the way from his wound. In the camp that day was the bespectacled Sturmbannführer Christian Wirth, inspector of the Aktion Reinhardt death camps. Wirth, who sported a toothbrush moustache in honour of his Führer, arrived on the square accompanied by Treblinka's terrifying deputy commander, Untersturmführer Kurt Franz, his large St. Bernard dog, Barry, straining on its lead. On Franz's order, 10 prisoners were dragged out and immediately shot as a warning to the others that resistance would not be tolerated. But this was not the end of the lesson. On the following day, another 150 Jews were taken out of roll call and shot. The Jews absorbed the message loud and clear. Individual acts of resistance against the SS were valiant, but ultimately futile. The killing of one SS man had cost the lives of 171 prisoners. It hadn't been worth it. If the Jews were to survive to bear witness to what was happening at Treblinka, then they had to find a better way to resist. The one thing that emerged out of Berliner's sacrifice was a decision by the SS to create a permanent Jewish Sonderkommando to help dispose of bodies, sort belongings, and maintain the fabric of the camp. No longer would the SS select a few hundred prisoners from incoming transports, work them for a few days, murder them, and then replace them with fresh people. New prisoners would be assigned to the existing Sonderkommando as and when required to replace prisoners who had died or been executed. This meant that a permanent force of Jews existed at Treblinka, and for the Jews, this meant that they had an opportunity of forming a resistance organization right under the Germans' noses. Treblinka, a name that today represents mass murder. To the Jews of Europe, it was almost entirely unknown. But Treblinka fitted into the carefully conceived Aktion Reinhardt plan to destroy the Jews of Europe. 3 specialized killing centers were constructed in quiet corners of Poland, into which were fed the Jewish populations of vast stretches of Europe. They were Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. They were designed and built by the same SS architect, Hauptsturmführer Richard Thomalla, and staffed by men who had been intimately involved with the T4 euthanasia program in Germany. Such men were already adept at gassing operations and were hardened mass murderers. There was already a camp at Treblinka that predated the more infamous Reinhardt facility. Known as Treblinka 1, it was founded on the 15th of November 1941. Treblinka was a nowhere place, a poor little village 50 miles northeast of Warsaw. Before the war, it was the site of a gravel pit whose product was used in making concrete. The advantage was that Treblinka was connected to most of the major Polish cities by the Malinia-Sokolov-Podlaski railway junction and had its own village train station. The SS quickly took over the gravel pit, which was used to supply materials for a road-building program in the Soviet Union. A A workforce of mostly Polish civilians was sent to the Treblinka 1 camp, usually on sentences of 6 months' hard labour, providing a stable workforce of approximately 1 to 2,000 prisoners. In command was a hard SS Totenkopfverbander, or SSTV officer, Sturmbannführer Theodor van Eupen. 34-year-old van Eupen claimed to be a German-Dutch aristocrat. Though well-mannered, he was a noted sadist who enjoyed personally shooting prisoners with his Luger. He was also less than popular among his SS colleagues for his disconcerting habit of dispatching subordinates to combat units on the Eastern Front for the slightest infractions of the regulations. Van Eupen had a pleasant garden and a duck pond constructed adjacent to his house, where his wife and two young sons were regular visitors. During the 3 years of its operation, over 20,000 people, including some German, Czech and French Jews, worked at Treblinka 1, and over 10,000 never left, dying of brutality, overwork, starvation, disease or accidents. Van Eupen and his subordinates terrorized the prisoners. He commanded several other SSTV officers and NCOs, and about 100 brutal SS Travnikis, Ukrainian and Latvian ex-Red Army prisoners of war who had changed sides. During the victorious advance of the Wehrmacht into the Soviet Union during Operation Barbarossa, 3 million, largely poorly educated peasant soldiers were captured in huge encirclements, as the Red Army, its military leadership crippled by the loss of its most experienced officers during Stalin's purges of 1938, struggled to resist numerically smaller but infinitely more modern, highly mobile and determined opponent. The Germans herded Soviet prisoners into huge, often open-air prison camps, where they were largely left to die of starvation, disease and brutality, this war crime being primarily the responsibility of the regular German army rather than the SS. After a few months, the survivors were used as slave labour, literally being worked to death alongside the Jews. However, the Germans realized that they also had an untapped manpower resource at their disposal that might be used for other purposes. One of the problems that faced Heinrich Himmler in his attempts to increase the size of his SS was access to German manpower. The German armed forces only permitted a small number of men to be conscripted each year to join the SS, so Himmler was forced to look elsewhere for personnel. The Ukrainian prisoners were often anti-Soviet and anti-Semitic, which made many of them perfect candidates for the SS. Many people across Europe at the time were deeply anti-communist, and many also had mixed feelings about the Jews, so the SS harnessed these feelings and recruited widely, especially among the embittered right-wingers who had opposed a war with Germany in the first place. Such foreign levies were outside of army recruitment restrictions, meaning that the SS soon became extremely diverse in national and even ethnic makeup. The SS recruited large numbers of French, Belgians and Dutch, alongside Finns, Danes and Norwegians. In the Baltic states, Estonians, Latvians and Lithuanians volunteered in large numbers. And there was even a tiny British contingent of the SS, largely recruited from among Sir Oswald Mosley's former blackshirt fascists who had been captured by the Germans while serving in the British Army. Named the British Free Corps, it only ever amounted to 3 dozen men and was actually rather an embarrassment to the Nazis. Himmler even permitted recruitment of Bosnian Muslims into the SS for use against Yugoslav partisans and Chetniks. The nickname Travnikis was derived from Travniki concentration camp, located southwest of the Polish city of Lublin, where the ex-Soviet soldiers were turned into SS auxiliaries. The camp had been established in 1941, and the first prisoners were, ironically, Soviet POWs and Polish Jews. In mid-1942, Jews from Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia arrived. In total, around 20,000 passed through the camp, most on their way to their deaths at Belzec extermination camp, or they were shot to death in nearby woods. In late 1942, Travniki became a manufacturing centre, using the Jews and other prisoners as forced labour, and this process was accelerated following the Warsaw Rising in April 1943, when 10,000 workers and many Warsaw factories were relocated to Travniki. In May 1943, more Jews from the Netherlands, Balyastok, Minsk and Smolensk in the Soviet Union were sent to Travniki. Approximately 10,000 were killed when the Germans initiated Operation Erntefest in autumn 1943, part of the 43,000 Jews in total who were murdered. One former guard recalled his training at Travniki. Quote, "You were taught there how to shoot with a gun, machine gun and submachine gun, and to throw grenades, and all this in the German language." Unquote. The ex-Soviets learned how to be German soldiers and SS men. Apart from drill and weapons training, Travniki also provided the Ukrainians with a pool of live prisoners for them to learn how to command, with the utmost brutality. They were kitted out in grey-brown uniforms with black collars and black forage caps adorned with the eagle and death's head insignia of the SS. Armed with Mauser rifles or holstered pistols, the Travnikis also routinely carried leather bullwhips. The extent to which the SS employed Ukrainians and other foreign soldiers is not particularly well known. Usually, a concentration camp would have a small German SS officer corps, along with a cadre of German NCOs who operated as junior management in the various sections of the camp. Most of the ordinary guards were Travniki volunteer SS Wachtmänner. At Treblinka I, the camp's second-in-command, SS Untersturmführer Franz Schwarz, enjoyed beating prisoners to death with a pickaxe or sledgehammer. But Treblinka I was a forced labour camp, or Arbeitslager, and though run extremely brutally, it was never the intention of Commandant van Eupen and his men, including the Travnikis, to kill the entire workforce. Treblinka II, however, was an entirely different institution with a very specific homicidal purpose. Treblinka II was the last of the three Reinhard camps to open after Belzec and Sobibor. Located just over a mile from Treblinka I, the camp's first commandant was a psychiatrist, Obersturmführer Dr. Irmfried Eberl. 31-year-old Eberl had been an early adherent of Hitler, joining the Austrian Nazi Party in 1931 while still a medical student at Innsbruck University. He had been heavily involved with the T4 euthanasia program as medical director of a killing facility in Brandenburg in 1940. Eberl, who sported a Hitler moustache and slick-back brown hair, was transferred to Treblinka II as commandant in July 1942, after a short spell at the Chełmno extermination camp. He rapidly gained a reputation among his SS colleagues as extremely ambitious. Treblinka II, in common with the Belzec and Sobibor camps, was divided into several distinct sections, each with a specific role in the process of genocide. Camp 1, or the Fornlager, contained the administration building, the Kommandantur, where the commandant, other officers, and senior NCOs had their offices. There was accommodation for the camp's 20 to 25 SSTV and 80 to 120 SS Travnikis, who lived separately from the Germans with their own messing facilities. A paved road, named Seidelstrasse after its supervisor of construction, Untersturmführer Kurt Seidel, passed through Camp 1 from the main gate on the north side. There were side roads paved in gravel. There was a kitchen, bakery and dining rooms staffed by Polish and Ukrainian prisoners, who formed a special Sonderkommando. They lived in two barracks inside Camp 1. Second-in-command of Treblinka II, the baby-faced Untersturmführer Kurt Franz, known to prisoners as the Doll, even set up a small zoo beside the horse stables that contained two foxes, a pair of peacocks, and a roe deer. Camp 1 also contained a laundry, tailor's shop, cobbler's, metalworking shop, and a small medical facility for the exclusive use of SS personnel. Camp 2, or the Auffangslager, was the receiving area where fresh transports of Jews would be processed through to Camp 3. The station platform where the evacuation train stopped had been disguised by the Germans to look like a regular Polish station, complete with terminal signs, a wooden clock and neat buildings. As at other extermination centres, an evacuation train normally consisted of 60 wagons packed with Jews. The platform could accommodate the offloading of 20 wagons at a time, so the process of admitting Jews into the camp was repeated 3 times for each shipment. SS-Scharführer Josef Hertreiter normally oversaw the offloading of the Jews. Any resistance or arguments were dealt with brutally. Troublemakers, as well as the sick, lame, or very elderly, were separated from the main transport and taken to a small building that was disguised as a lazaret, or medical center. In reality, there was a deep pit behind the building. Here, Unterscharführer Willy Mentz, nicknamed Frankenstein, would shoot the prisoners in the back of the head, often assisted by his boss, Scharführer August Mieter. For the rest of the transport, they would progress to 2 long barracks manned by Jewish Sonderkommandos, where the prisoners would undress, pass by a cashier's booth where they were told to deposit their valuables for safekeeping, and to an area where women and children would have their heads shaved. The Sonderkommandos, who searched and sorted them, would collect the piles of clothing. Screened from the railway line and Camp 2 by a high earthen bank was Camp 3. The fences around this area of Treblinka too were camouflaged with tree branches that were woven into the fences, and parts of the original forest had been retained as a further screen to prying eyes. The undressing barracks in Camp 2 was connected to Camp 3 via a long fence corridor that the SS sarcastically nicknamed the Himmelstrasse, Road to Heaven. At the end of the fence corridor were the gas chambers and large open-air cremation facilities, and several massive burial pits. Here also were 300 Sonderkommandos who were forced to assist in the killing process and who lived in a separate barracks directly behind the gas chambers. In total, there were between 800 and 1,000 Jews who were kept alive for a short time to work as Sonderkommandos. They were subject to arbitrary executions or beatings from the SS, and when they died, strong new men selected from arriving transports replaced them. In Camp 2, each Sonderkommando unit wore a coloured badge to aid identification and control by the SS. Kommando Blau, Unit Blue, manned the rail ramp and platform, unlocked the wagons, and also cleaned them out after their human cargo had been emptied. Kommando Rot, Unit Red, was the biggest Sonderkommando. They unpacked and sorted the belongings of the arrivals and delivered them to special storage barracks. Kommando Gelb, Unit Yellow, separated items by quality, removed the Star of David badge from all clothing, and extracted any money that arrivals had sewn into their clothes. The Desinfektionskommando disinfected the arrivals' belongings and the sacks of hair. The Goldjuden collected and collated banknotes and evaluated gold and jewellery under the watchful eyes of SS NCOs. The 300 Sonderkommando who worked in the gas chambers and crematorium facilities were called Todenjuden, Jews of Death, by the SS. Suicides in the Todenjuden barracks ran at 15 to 20 a day, the shortfall in labour being made up by the SS from new arrivals. Finally, there was the Holzfällerkommando, a group used to cut wood in the surrounding forest for the crematoria, and the Tarnungskommando, or disguise unit, whose job was to refresh the foliage that was woven into the barbed wire fences to prevent any unauthorized persons from seeing what was going on inside this part of the camp. Although regular SS were in charge of the gas chambers, they relied heavily upon Ukrainian auxiliaries to get the Jews into the killing facilities after they had been driven up the Himmelstrasse. Quote, "I met Ivan Marchenko in August 1942 in the Treblinka death camp, where he served as a guard in a guard company," wrote former SS Wachtmann Alexander Jaeger on the 16th of April 1948 whilst in Soviet captivity. Stalin's secret police, the NKVD, had launched an operation to investigate the Aktion Reinhardt death camps, and one name had kept coming up, Ivan the Terrible. The Ukrainian guard of fearsome and sadistic reputation, Ivan had apparently tortured and mutilated Jews on the way to their deaths. Former comrades had identified Ivan as a certain Ivan Marchenko, and he would be sought for decades after the war by survivors' groups desperate to bring the SS auxiliary to justice. quote, "he viciously beat and shot persons of Jewish nationality," unquote, reported former SS auxiliary Jaeger. Quote, "At the end of 1943, after the destruction of a camp, he left for Italy along with the commander of the camp. I never saw him after that, and I do not know where he is now," unquote. Another former SS auxiliary named Pavel Leleko recalled on the 21st of February 1945 the scene before the gas chambers at Treblinka. Quote, "When the procession of the condemned approached the gas chambers, the motorists of the gas chambers, Marchenko and Nikolai Sheliev, would shout, 'Go quickly, or the water will get cold.' Five or six German SS, with dogs, clubs and whips, would help the two Ukrainians fill the gas chambers, using the utmost savagery as the Jews realized what was going to be done to them. Quote, "In this the Germans would compete with the motorists in brutality towards the people selected to die. Marchenko, for instance, had a sword with him, which he mutilated the people. He cut off the breasts of women," unquote. Alexandra Kirpa, a Ukrainian forced labourer who worked as a maid in the German SS quarters at Treblinka, recalled on the 18th of April 1951, quote, "The man identified to me as Ivan Ivanovich Marchenko served in the SS detachment. He wore a black uniform of the German SS forces and was armed with a pistol. On the shoulder strap he wore one or two, I do not recall exactly, white stripes and had the rank of Oberwachtmann or Gruppenwachtmann. To this day, Ivan Marchenko has never been positively identified or captured. For many years, a former Ukrainian SS guard named Ivan John Demyanyuk, who was living in the United States, was believed to be Ivan the Terrible, and he faced trial on several occasions, but the evidence against Demyanyuk was never conclusive. In 1951, when he applied to emigrate to America, Demyanyuk gave his mother's maiden name as Marchenko. Coincidence, perhaps, but many suspected that the Ivan Marchenko at Treblinka had been using an assumed name. The Ukrainian SS were, after all, traitors and collaborators. John Demyanyuk died in 2012. Some Jews had attempted individual escapes from Treblinka too, while others had even attempted acts of sabotage. Some people had managed to return to nearby ghettos, or even to Warsaw, and try to warn others about what was happening at Treblinka. One man had managed to escape from Treblinka after 18 days and later fought in the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. Occasional escapes were made by Sonderkommandos concealing themselves in freight trains that left Treblinka loaded with belongings and loot taken from Jewish victims. In early December 1942, seven escapees were caught attempting this way out. They were shot on Deputy Commandant Franz's orders. But the SS were always keen to terrify and cow their prisoners, so Franz also ordered that for each Jew that escaped, a further 10 prisoners would be shot. So this one escape attempt ended up costing the lives of 77 people. Prisoners working in Camp 3, the death camp, constructed an escape tunnel. A breakout was attempted on the night of the 31st of December 1942, five men managing to get free under German fire. The SS recaptured four of them soon afterwards. Of the four, one was shot on the spot, while the other three were brought back to Treblinka and publicly hanged in front of the assembled Sonderkommandos as a warning. The unfortunate outcome of the tunnel was that the Germans beefed up the camp's perimeter defences to make any attempts on or under the wire much more difficult. Six large wooden guard towers armed with machine guns were constructed, overlooking all areas of the camp. One of the most notorious acts of resistance involved a hand grenade. One day, a line of male prisoners shuffled forward into the undressing barracks, their clothes tatty and soiled from their journey from Warsaw 50 miles away. Escorting them were several hard-looking Ukrainian SS auxiliaries with Mauser rifles slung over their shoulders. Standing apart from them was a German SS sergeant, a coiled whip grasped firmly in one hand. He was yelling orders, to which the Ukrainians responded by pushing and shoving the Jewish prisoners. Occasional shots were fired into the air to encourage the prisoners forward. The shipment had arrived fresh from the crushing of the Warsaw Ghetto and contained several ZOB fighters. As the men undressed, piling their grimy clothing on benches that the SS provided, one young man hesitated. During the uprising, he had fought valiantly until captured in the ruins of the ghetto and been sent to the camp to be killed. But unknown to the SS, the ZOB fighter had managed to conceal a single hand grenade on his person. In their urgency to clear the ghetto and move the prisoners to camps, the Germans accidentally overlooked the odd weapon that was well concealed. The fighter was under no illusions about where this particular road ended, no matter what lies the Germans had told the prisoners on the station platform when the train had first pulled in. Waiting until the crowd had thinned a little, as prisoners moved to the next section of their processing, the fighter quickly dug the grenade out from its hiding place in the folds of his clothing, and yelling a defiant message in Polish, wrenched out the pin. The detonation of the grenade inside the undressing barracks caused prisoners and guards and the rest of the camp to involuntarily duck. The windows in the barracks were blown out, smoke rising from their glassless frames. To guttural cries of "Alarm!" German SS came running, drawing their Luger pistols from their holsters, ready for anything. They thought that a rebellion had begun. But it was only the final act of a brave man who had lost his battle of resistance against the Nazis. The SS were frightened and shaken by the grenade incident. If they had but known it, their cowed prisoners were even then planning the uprising that they so badly feared. The Jews who slaved for the Germans, the poor wretches who were forced to help the SS to kill their own people, were planning a mass escape.